A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's basically two questions wrapped in a larger tension. He's been mapping housing markets across geographies and landed on a conviction: a stable rental market might actually facilitate human potential better than home ownership does. The missing piece, he says, is regulation that stops us from treating rental housing like any other commodity. And the framework he wants us to explore is the landlord registry. A system that protects tenants from serial slumlords without burying decent landlords in compliance nightmares. Has anywhere come close to getting this right? And what can we learn from their attempts?
This is one of those ideas that sounds almost too obvious when you say it out loud. Of course we should know which landlords have a history of leaving mold untreated for 6 months. Of course, tenants should be able to check that before signing a lease. And yet most rental markets operate on a system where the landlord knows everything about you, your credit score, your income, your rental history, and you know nothing about them except what they choose to tell you in a 15-minute viewing.
It's the information asymmetry equivalent of a blind date, where one person has a full dossier and the other gets a name tag.
The asymmetry isn't accidental. It's baked into how we treat housing. We think of rental units as interchangeable widgets. Apartment A and Apartment B are both three-bedroom units in the same neighborhood, so the market should sort out the price difference. But Apartment A has a landlord who responds to maintenance requests within 48 hours, and Apartment B has a landlord who's been taken to small claims court 4 times in 3 years. That information exists, but it's scattered across court records, tenant WhatsApp groups, and the memories of people who've moved out. It's not actionable.
This is where the registry idea gets interesting, because it's not rent control, it's not price intervention, it's a transparency mechanism, which means it sidesteps the usual ideological battles about housing policy.
That's what makes it a practical intervention worth examining right now. Israel's rental law, Hak HaSekurut, has been under scrutiny for years, and the conversation keeps getting stuck on the same fault line. Tenant advocates want stronger protections. Landlord groups warn that overregulation will shrink the rental supply. A registry doesn't directly regulate rents or eviction procedures. It just makes landlord behavior visible, and visibility changes incentives.
The question is whether visibility alone is enough, or whether the design details, who can see what, who adjudicates disputes, what happens when a landlord gets flagged, make or break the whole thing.
That's where the global case studies get fascinating, because several jurisdictions have actually tried this. Scotland launched a full landlord registration system in 2006 under the Antisocial Behaviour, etc. Act. Every private landlord in Scotland has to register with their local council. As of 2024, that's over 200,000 registered landlords. If you don't register, you can face fines up to £50,000, and renting out an unregistered property is a criminal offence.
£50,000 is a real penalty. That's not a parking ticket.
It's not. And they've had about 1,500 prosecutions for non-registration over 18 years, which tells you something about enforcement. It's real, but it's not sweeping. The system's backbone is what they call the fit and proper person test. If you have certain criminal convictions, fraud, violence, drug trafficking, housing law violations, you can be refused registration or struck off. And local councils have the power to revoke registration if a landlord is found to be failing their legal duties.
The Scottish system already answers one of the core tensions in Daniel's prompt. There's a mechanism for removing bad actors. The flip side is what happens when a tenant files a complaint that's frivolous or retaliatory. How does Scotland handle that?
That's where it gets interesting, and honestly, a bit patchy. The fit and proper person test is applied by the local council, not by an automated system. A landlord isn't automatically struck off because of a complaint. There's a process. But the enforcement varies by council. Some councils are aggressive, others are barely resourced. In 2022, a Scottish government review found that only about 60% of councils were actively monitoring compliance. So the system exists, but the rigor depends on where you live.
It's a framework with teeth that sometimes bite and sometimes gum.
That's a remarkably vivid way to put it, and that uneven enforcement is one of the biggest criticisms. The other is that the registration fee, £70 per landlord, not per property, is low enough that it doesn't create a meaningful barrier to entry, which is good, but also doesn't fund robust enforcement, which is bad.
£70 per landlord, not per property. So if I own 12 flats, I pay £70 once.
Compare that to New York City's approach. The Public Advocate's Office launched the Landlord Watch List in 2019. It's a public database that tracks buildings with the most housing code complaints based on 311 data. It's updated quarterly and assigns buildings a ranking based on the volume of open violations. But it only covers buildings with three or more units, which means single-family rentals and two-family homes, a huge chunk of the market, are completely invisible.
It catches the big portfolio landlords, but misses the small-timers, who might be just as negligent.
It's purely complaint-driven. If a tenant doesn't call 311, the violation doesn't exist in the database. That creates a bias toward buildings where tenants are more informed and more willing to engage with city systems. Immigrant communities, non-English speakers, people who are afraid of retaliation, they're underrepresented in the data.
Which means the registry reflects not just landlord behavior but tenant empowerment, which is a different thing entirely.
That's the core design tension. A registry is only as good as the data it captures, and the data is only as good as the tenant's willingness and ability to report. If you don't design for that, you end up with a system that makes the best landlords look clean and the worst landlords look clean too, because their tenants are too intimidated to complain.
The question becomes, how do you build a registry that captures reality rather than just the subset of reality that tenants feel safe reporting?
This brings us to the second part of the tension, the landlord's side. Because if you make it too easy to file complaints, you risk creating a weapon. A tenant who's being evicted for non-payment can file a retaliatory complaint about the condition of the property, and suddenly the landlord has a black mark that might take months to resolve.
In a tight rental market, a landlord with a black mark might struggle to fill units even if the complaint was baseless. The damage is done the moment the complaint becomes public.
Which is why the right to reply mechanism is so critical. In Scotland, landlords can challenge complaints through the council process. In New York, landlords can contest violations through the housing court, but that process can take over a year, and the violation stays visible on the watch list while it's being contested. So the landlord's reputation is damaged during the entire adjudication period.
That's the musical equivalent of guilty until proven innocent.
That's not just a fairness issue, it's a design flaw that undermines the legitimacy of the whole system. If landlords don't trust the registry, they'll fight it politically, and they'll win. You need buy-in from both sides, or the system collapses.
We're looking for a Goldilocks registry. Enough transparency to expose serial slumlords, enough due process to protect decent landlords from weaponized complaints, and enough enforcement to make the whole thing more than a suggestion box.
That's before we even get to the question of what data the registry should contain. Because complaint history is vague, a complaint about a broken elevator is different from a complaint about chipped paint in the hallway. If you don't categorize complaints by severity, you end up with a system where a landlord with 50 minor cosmetic issues looks worse than a landlord with 3 unresolved safety hazards.
The registry needs a taxonomy of complaints, a way to distinguish between the hot water has been out for 2 weeks, and the lobby carpet is a color I don't like.
This is where Toronto's RentSafe TO program offers a different model. Launched in 2017, it's not a landlord registry per se, it's a building rating system. Apartment buildings with 3 or more stories and 10 or more units get inspected by the city and rated on a scale from A to F. The rating is based on actual inspections, not complaints. So it captures problems that tenants might not report. Structural issues, fire safety violations, pest infestations that people have just learned to live with.
An inspection-based system rather than a complaint-based system. That's a fundamentally different approach.
The results are striking. Buildings that received an F rating saw a 40% increase in maintenance spending within 2 years. Public shaming works, at least when it's backed by the threat of enforcement. The city can issue orders to comply, and if landlords don't fix the problems, they can face fines or even have the city do the repairs and build them.
40% is not a marginal nudge. That's a behavioral shift.
It happened without rent control, without price caps, without any of the heavy-handed interventions that landlords typically resist. It was pure transparency plus enforcement. The rating becomes a market signal. Tenants see a building rated D, and they think twice. Landlords see their vacancy rates creeping up, and they fix the problems.
The market actually works better when information flows both ways, which is the core insight behind the registry concept. It's not about overriding market forces, it's about making them function properly by fixing the information asymmetry.
That's the argument that can actually build political consensus. Tenant advocates get a tool to identify and pressure bad landlords. Good landlords get a way to distinguish themselves from the slumlords who give the whole industry a bad name. And policymakers get a mechanism that doesn't require massive new spending or price controls.
The good landlords should be the biggest supporters of this. Right now, they're competing against people who undercut them by deferring maintenance, and tenants can't tell the difference until the ceiling starts leaking.
That's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. A registry protects good landlords from unfair competition. If you're a landlord who fixes things promptly and treats tenants fairly, you want that to be visible. You want tenants to know that your properties are different from the guy down the street who hasn't updated the wiring since 1972.
It's the Yelpification of rental housing, but with actual regulatory teeth behind the ratings.
We know from other industries that rating systems change behavior even without enforcement. Restaurants that get poor health inspection scores lose customers. Uber drivers with low ratings get fewer rides. The transparency itself creates the incentive.
Though we should probably acknowledge that Yelp is also a cautionary tale about review systems. Fake reviews, review bombing, businesses pressuring customers to remove negative reviews, all of that would play out in a landlord registry too.
And that's why the design details matter so much. Do you allow anonymous complaints? If yes, you get more honest reporting but also more potential for abuse. If no, you get fewer complaints but higher quality ones. Do you require evidence, photos, correspondence, inspection reports before a complaint is published? Do you have a threshold of multiple complaints before a landlord gets flagged to prevent one-off disputes from becoming permanent black marks?
These aren't edge cases. These are the questions that determine whether the system works or becomes another bureaucratic layer that everyone learns to ignore.
We haven't even touched on the shell company problem. In markets like New York and London, many bad landlords operate through limited liability companies. If a landlord gets a terrible record under one LLC, they can just create a new one and keep operating. A registry that doesn't pierce the corporate veil is a registry that can be gamed.
You need to register the beneficial owner, not just the legal entity, which gets into a whole different set of privacy and compliance questions.
This is where the Israeli context gets particularly interesting, because Israel's rental market has its own structural quirks. About 30% of Israeli households rent, that's roughly 1.5 million rental units according to the Central Bureau of Statistics 2023 data. But the landlord side is highly fragmented. You have a lot of small landlords who own one or two units, often as an investment or inheritance property. They're not professional property managers. They're dentists and retirees and people who inherited their grandmother's apartment in Tel Aviv.
Which means any registry system has to be designed for people who don't have compliance departments. If the registration process requires a lawyer and three forms and a visit to a government office, half the small landlords just won't do it.
That's exactly what happened in Scotland's early years. Compliance was lowest among accidental landlords, people who owned a single rental property almost by default. They didn't see themselves as landlords, didn't know about the registration requirement, and weren't plugged into landlord associations that could tell them. The Scottish government had to run public awareness campaigns to reach them.
The registry also functions as a way to educate landlords about their obligations. The act of registering forces you to learn what the rules are.
Which is a second-order benefit that nobody talks about. A landlord who registers and reads through the requirements is a landlord who now knows that they're legally obligated to provide a safe living environment, to protect tenant deposits, to give proper notice before entry. Some of them genuinely don't know these things until someone tells them.
The registry is an onboarding tool. That's actually a compelling argument for making registration mandatory rather than voluntary. If it's voluntary, the landlords who need the education most are the ones least likely to sign up.
And that brings us back to the enforcement question. A mandatory registry only works if there are consequences for non-compliance. Scotland has the £50,000 fine. Toronto has the building ratings and repair orders. New York has the watch list and the court system. Each approach has different strengths and weaknesses.
What about places that have tried something more radical? I'm thinking of New Zealand. Didn't they introduce something around rental standards recently?
New Zealand's approach is different but instructive. They introduced the Healthy Home Standards in 2019, which set minimum requirements for heating, insulation, ventilation, and drainage in rental properties. It's not a landlord registry in the sense we're discussing. It doesn't create a public database of landlord behavior. But it does require landlords to certify that their properties meet the standards, and tenants can challenge non-compliance through the tenancy tribunal.
It's a standards-based approach rather than a transparency-based approach. You're not rating landlords publicly, but you're giving tenants a clear benchmark and a mechanism to enforce it.
The compliance data from the tenancy tribunal is public, so, in a sense, it creates a de facto registry of landlords who've been found in violation. But you have to dig through tribunal decisions to find it. It's not aggregated in a user-friendly way.
Which is the difference between information that technically exists and information that's actually useful to a tenant trying to decide where to live?
This is the core design principle that separates good registries from bad ones. The information has to be accessible and actionable. A database that requires a law degree to interpret is not a consumer protection tool. It's a filing cabinet.
The Scottish system has an online portal where tenants can check if a landlord is registered. It's simple. You enter the property address and it tells you yes or no. But it doesn't tell you about complaint history or enforcement actions. So it's a registration verification tool, not a behavior tracking tool.
That's the gap. Knowing that a landlord is registered tells you they've cleared the minimum bar of not being a convicted fraudster. It doesn't tell you whether they respond to maintenance requests or have a pattern of withholding deposits.
The question becomes, what's the next evolution? How do you take a system like Scotland's and layer on behavioral data without creating the retaliatory complaint problem we talked about?
I think the answer is in the data architecture. If you design the registry to track specific, verifiable metrics rather than subjective complaints, you reduce the potential for abuse. Maintenance request response time is objective. Either the leak was fixed within the legally required period, or it wasn't. Eviction records with cause are objective. Either the eviction was for non-payment, or it was a no-fault eviction. These are things that can be documented and verified, not just alleged.
You'd want to include resolution status. A complaint that was filed and resolved within a week is a very different signal from a complaint that's been open for 6 months.
The registry should show not just that complaints were filed, but how they were handled. A landlord with 20 complaints that were all resolved promptly looks better than a landlord with 3 complaints that were all ignored. The narrative is in the response, not just the initial problem.
Which also gives landlords an incentive to resolve issues quickly. If you know that an open complaint is going to sit on your public record, you're going to close it as fast as possible.
That's the proactive shift we want. Right now, in a market with no registry, the landlord's incentive is to delay maintenance as long as possible because every repair is a cost and there's no reputational consequence for being slow. A registry flipped that calculation. The cost of delay becomes visible, and that visibility has consequences.
There's something almost Hayekian about this. The registry is a mechanism for aggregating dispersed information. All those individual tenant experiences that currently exist only in private memory, and turning it into a price signal. A landlord with a bad record has to charge lower rent or face higher vacancy rates. The market adjusts.
Unlike rent control, which creates shortages by capping prices below market levels, a registry doesn't interfere with the price mechanism. It just makes the price mechanism more informed. Tenants can still choose to rent from a landlord with a mediocre record if the price is right, but they're making that choice with their eyes open.
The informed consent model of rental housing. I actually like that framing.
It aligns with how we treat almost every other consumer market. We have safety ratings for cars, hygiene ratings for restaurants, efficiency ratings for appliances. We accept that consumers deserve information about what they're buying. Housing is the largest single expense for most households, and we've somehow decided that renters should operate in the dark about the seller's track record.
Though we should acknowledge the counterargument, which is that housing isn't like other consumer goods. If you buy a bad toaster, you return it. If you rent from a bad landlord, you're stuck for the term of the lease, and moving is expensive and disruptive. The stakes are higher, which means the potential for registry errors to cause real harm is also higher.
Which is exactly why the due process mechanisms matter so much. A restaurant that gets an unfair health rating can challenge it and stay open. A landlord who gets unfairly flagged in a public registry could lose tenants and income before they have a chance to clear their name. The system has to protect against that.
We've identified the core tension. A registry needs to be public enough to be useful and fair enough to be legitimate. Scotland gives us the basic framework. New York gives us the complaint-driven model and its limitations. Toronto gives us the inspection-based alternative. And New Zealand gives us the standards-based approach.
None of them have fully solved the problem. Scotland's system has been operating for nearly 2 decades and enforcement is still patchy. New York's watch list misses large segments of the market. Toronto's system only covers larger buildings. New Zealand's standards don't aggregate into a user-friendly database.
Which means there's room for a jurisdiction that looks at all of these and synthesizes the best elements. And that's where Israel could actually leapfrog.
Israel has some advantages here. The rental market is concentrated in a relatively small geographic area. The population is tech literate. The government already has infrastructure for digital identity and property registration through the land registry, the TABU. Piggybacking a landlord registry onto the existing TABU system is technically feasible in a way that might not be in a larger, more fragmented country.
Israel's rental law, Chuk HaSekurut, already establishes some tenant protections. The registry wouldn't be creating new rights from scratch. It would be creating a mechanism to enforce existing rights more effectively.
The law already says landlords have to maintain the property in a habitable condition. The law already says they have to protect tenant deposits. The problem isn't the absence of rules, it's the absence of accountability for breaking them. A registry closes that gap.
We've got the conceptual framework, the global case studies, and the Israeli context. What we haven't done yet is wrestle with the hardest design questions. How do you structure the complaint and resolution system to be fair to both sides? How do you handle the shell company problem? Should the registry be fully public, or should some data be accessible only to regulators?
Those are the questions that determine whether a registry actually works or becomes another well-intentioned policy that everyone learns to ignore. Which I think is where we should go next.
Let's do it. Because the difference between a registry that changes behavior and a registry that's just a government website nobody visits is entirely in the design details.
That's the conversation that most policy debates never get to. They argue about whether to have a registry at all, and they never get to the part where you figure out how to make it good.
Which is, in miniature, the story of most housing policy debates.
Let's step back and define what we're actually talking about here. A landlord registry, in the form that's worth discussing, is a centralized database that tracks the relationship between landlords and their rental history across properties. Not just whether they're registered, but how they behave.
The key distinction, which I think gets lost in a lot of these conversations, is that this isn't a tenant blacklist in reverse. Tenant screening services already exist. They tell landlords which tenants have evictions or bad credit. They're entirely one-sided.
The information asymmetry runs in one direction. A landlord can pull a credit report, an eviction history, a criminal background check on a prospective tenant before ever handing over the keys. The tenant, meanwhile, is expected to sign a year-long contract based on a 15-minute walkthrough and whatever vibe they got from the person showing the apartment.
The vibe-based housing market. What could go wrong?
That's the core problem. The existing databases, tenant screening services, rental history reports, they're all designed to protect landlords from bad tenants. There is no equivalent infrastructure to protect tenants from bad landlords. A landlord registry flips that dynamic, or at least balances it.
How is this different from, say, a Yelp for landlords? Because that's the obvious counterargument. Just let tenants leave reviews online and call it a day.
A few critical differences. First, a proper registry is tied to verified identities and legal entities, not anonymous usernames. You can't create a shell company and review bomb your own properties. Second, the data in a registry is structured. Specific metrics like complaint resolution time, not just star ratings and angry paragraphs. And third, a registry has legal consequences. If you're struck off, you can't rent. A bad Yelp review just means you need better PR.
The legal consequence piece is the part that separates a registry from a review site. A review site creates social pressure. A registry creates regulatory pressure. And regulatory pressure is what you need when social pressure isn't enough, which, in a housing market where demand outstrips supply, it almost never is.
Because, in a tight market, tenants will rent from anyone. They don't have the luxury of being picky. A landlord with a 1-star Yelp rating in Tel Aviv is still going to have 50 applicants for every unit. The market doesn't punish bad behavior when vacancy rates are near zero. The state has to.
That's the framing that I think gets missed. This isn't about creating a consumer choice tool for tenants who have options. It's about creating an accountability mechanism for tenants who don't.
Which brings us to what a registry actually contains. At minimum, you'd want the property address, the landlord's legal identity, and this is where the shell company problem gets interesting. Complaint history with resolution status, maintenance response times, eviction records with cause, and any enforcement actions taken by housing authorities.
The resolution status is the part that protects good landlords. If a complaint was filed and resolved within the legally required window, that shouldn't be a black mark. It should actually be a green mark. It shows responsiveness.
That's the difference between a registry that tracks problems and a registry that tracks behavior. A problem-tracking registry just counts complaints. A behavior-tracking registry counts responses. The first one punishes landlords who rent older properties that need more maintenance. The second one distinguishes between a landlord who fixes things and a landlord who doesn't.
The design question is, how do you build a system where the data tells the right story? Where a landlord with a 100-year-old building and a dozen resolved complaints looks better than a landlord with a new building and 3 ignored ones? And that leads us to an uncomfortable question. What stops a tenant from filing a retaliatory complaint because the landlord raised the rent or enforced a no-pets clause? If every complaint goes public immediately, the registry becomes a weapon.
This is where Scotland's system is actually instructive in what it gets right and what it gets wrong. Under the Anti-Social Behaviour Act of 2004, which took effect in 2006, Scotland requires every private landlord to pass a fit and proper person test. Certain criminal convictions, fraud, violence, drug trafficking, disqualify you from registration entirely. But the complaint mechanism is separate. Complaints go to the local council, not directly onto a public-facing database. The council investigates before anything becomes visible.
There's a filter. The tenant files a complaint, but it doesn't show up on the registry until someone with regulatory authority has verified it. That's the difference between a registry and a public pillory.
That's the part that critics of registries often miss. They imagine a website where anyone can post anything, and suddenly a landlord's reputation is destroyed by a disgruntled tenant with a grudge and a keyboard. But a properly designed registry isn't crowdsourced. It's curated. The data is validated.
The Wikipedia model versus the government database model. Wikipedia works because the community corrects errors, but for something with legal consequences, you need editorial control. The council investigator is the editor.
Councils in Scotland have real teeth. They can issue rent penalty notices, essentially preventing a landlord from collecting rent on a property if they fail to register or fail to address serious complaints. As of 2024, over 200,000 landlords are registered, and while the prosecution numbers are modest, about 1,500 for non-registration over 18 years, the existence of the registry creates a baseline. You can't be a landlord in Scotland without being on the list.
1,500 prosecutions over 18 years works out to about 83 a year. That's not nothing, but it's also not exactly a regulatory juggernaut. Which councils are actually enforcing this?
Glasgow and Edinburgh are the most active. Some of the smaller councils have essentially no enforcement capacity. And that's one of the lessons. A registry only works if the enforcement body is resourced. You can't just pass the law and walk away. The database is the foundation, but the investigators are the load-bearing walls.
Let's talk about the strike-off mechanism specifically. A landlord who gets complaints needs a path to challenge them. What does that look like in practice?
Scotland has a tribunal system. The first-tier tribunal for Scotland handles private rental disputes. A landlord can appeal a council's decision to strike them from the register or impose penalties. The tribunal reviews evidence from both sides and issues a binding ruling. The process isn't fast. It can take months, but it exists.
Months is a long time if you're a landlord whose registration has been suspended and you can't collect rent. That's the due process tension in a nutshell. You want to protect tenants from bad actors, but you also don't want to destroy a good landlord's livelihood while they wait for a hearing.
Which is why the threshold for suspension versus the threshold for investigation matters. In an ideal system, a complaint triggers an investigation, not an automatic suspension. The landlord remains registered while the investigation proceeds, unless the complaint involves an immediate health and safety risk. No heat in winter, black mold, structural hazards. In those cases, expedited review makes sense.
A triage system. Green complaints get logged and investigated on a normal timeline. Red complaints trigger emergency review. That's reasonable.
It's actually what Toronto's RentSafe TAO does, though through a different mechanism. Their building ratings are based on inspections, not complaints, but the inspection triggers can come from tenant reports. If enough tenants in a building report the same issue, pests, water damage, elevator failures, the city escalates the inspection priority. It's complaint-informed, but inspection-verified.
Which circles back to the data architecture question. What fields do you actually put in this thing, so that it tells a useful story without becoming a bureaucratic black hole?
The minimum viable registry, I think, has 5 core fields per property. 1, the legal identity of the landlord or the beneficial owner if it's a corporate entity. 2, the complaint history with resolution status. Filed, under investigation, substantiated, resolved, dismissed. 3, maintenance request response times, benchmarked against a legal standard. 4, eviction records with the stated cause and whether the eviction was contested or uncontested. 5, any enforcement actions, fines, or license suspensions.
The eviction records piece is interesting because it cuts both ways. A landlord with a lot of evictions for non-payment of rent might be a landlord who enforces the lease seriously. A landlord with a lot of evictions immediately after tenants file maintenance complaints might be a retaliatory evictor. The raw number doesn't tell you anything without the context.
Which is why the with cause field is essential. It's not enough to say 3 evictions in 2 years. You need to know whether those were for non-payment, property damage, illegal activity, or... And this is the red flag, immediately following a tenant complaint about habitability.
The timing pattern is the signal, and that's where a registry that tracks dates, not just events, becomes powerful. You can see sequences. Complaint filed on March 1st, eviction notice served on March 15th. That's not a coincidence, that's a pattern.
Patterns are what individual tenants can't see, but regulators can. A single tenant who gets evicted after complaining about mold thinks they had a bad experience. A regulator looking at the registry sees that the same landlord has evicted 4 tenants within 60 days of maintenance complaints over 3 years. That's not a bad experience. That's a business model.
The slumlord's business model made visible. That's the whole point.
Now, the shell company problem. This is where the New York watch list is instructive in its limitations. The watch list tracks complaints by building address and by the owner of record. But if the owner of record is an LLC that dissolves and reforms under a different name, the complaint history doesn't follow.
You need to tie the registry to the beneficial owner, not just the legal entity, the human being behind the shell company.
That's hard. It requires either a legal requirement that all rental property LLCs disclose their beneficial owners, or a cross-reference with tax records and corporate registrations. Scotland's system requires individual landlords to register with their name, date of birth, and address. Corporate landlords have to identify a named individual who meets the fit and proper person test. You can't hide behind a limited company.
Which means the registry doesn't just track properties, it tracks people. And that's the part that makes some landlords deeply uncomfortable, because it removes the anonymity that shell companies provide.
That discomfort is the point. If you're a good landlord, transparency is not a threat. Your record speaks for itself. The only landlords who need anonymity are the ones who have something to hide.
Though, I'll push back slightly. There are legitimate privacy concerns even for good landlords. A small landlord who owns a single unit and rents it out while living next door. Do they really want their home address, their personal complaint history, their eviction records publicly searchable by anyone with an internet connection?
That's the public versus private registry debate, and I think the answer is probably tiered, Basic registration data. Yes, this person is a registered landlord. Yes, they're in good standing. Should be public. Tenants should be able to verify that their prospective landlord is legal, but the detailed complaint history, the resolution timelines, the eviction records? That might be better suited for a system where tenants can request a report with the landlord's consent, similar to how credit checks work.
The tenant says, "I'd like to rent this apartment." The landlord authorizes a registry report, and the tenant sees the relevant history. That balances transparency with privacy.
It mirrors the existing tenant screening process. The landlord pulls a credit report on the tenant. The tenant pulls a registry report on the landlord.
Symmetry in a relationship that has historically been anything but symmetrical. I like it. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1908, a French expeditionary geologist in Djibouti accidentally sealed a live ant colony inside a concrete survey marker, and the ants responded by laying down an elaborate pheromone trail network that directed the entire colony in a perfect spiral until they exhausted themselves. A behavior that a British entomologist later described as the first recorded instance of insects inventing a maze with no exit.
Right.
The credit report symmetry model actually brings us to the second order behavioral question. What happens when landlords know the response times and complaint resolutions are being tracked? Does it change how they operate before problems arise?
The preemptive fix. Instead of waiting for the ceiling to leak and the tenant to complain, you inspect the roof. The registry creates a paper trail, and a paper trail creates an incentive to keep the paper clean.
Toronto's Rent Safe TO data backs this up. Buildings that got an F rating in the first evaluation cycle increased maintenance spending by 40% within 2 years. Not because the city fined them into submission, the ratings themselves created reputational pressure. Landlords don't want to be the F building.
The scarlet letter effect, but for property management, which is interesting because it suggests the registry doesn't just punish bad behavior, it shifts the baseline. The acceptable standard moves from not currently flooding to provably maintaining.
That shift is exactly what Israel's rental market lacks. Under Hak HaSekirut, the current rental law, there's no mechanism for tracking a landlord's history across properties or across time. Each dispute is treated as a one-off. A tenant in Tel Aviv has no way of knowing that the same landlord left a family in Haifa without hot water for 6 months.
The landlord's record resets every time they sign a new lease with a new tenant. It's the informational equivalent of a fugue state.
The practical question is, where would a registry even live in the Israeli system? The TABA framework, the tenant protection legal structure, already exists. It handles disputes, it defines habitability standards. A registry could be piggybacked onto it or integrated with the Ministry of Housing's existing property database.
The Ministry of Housing already tracks property tax records, ownership, building permits. Adding a complaint and compliance layer isn't starting from zero. It's adding a column to a spreadsheet that's already mostly built.
The scale is manageable. Israel has about 1.5 million rental units, with roughly 30% of households renting. That's not a small number, but it's not an ungovernable data problem either. Scotland manages it with 200,000 registered landlords. Israel's registry would be larger, but not orders of magnitude larger.
Here's the question, though. You mentioned Toronto's ratings creating reputational pressure, but that pressure only works if tenants have options. In a high-demand market like Tel Aviv, where apartments get snapped up within.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.